Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. All right, happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday. So, we're having some problems with Greg's audio. Hopefully that won't be too much of a problem, at least maybe not for too long. Anyway, Greg, why don't you just tell us what topics we have on tap for this week?
All right. If you can understand me, we have a great set of questions on the special seven virtues, signs of repression, the ethics of care for the body, and more.
So, folks, if you are listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
All right. What's been going on this week?
I have a ridiculous amount of news this week. So it's actually four things here. So, first of all, the book version of Explore Atlas Shrugged is now available on Amazon and Kindle and paperback, and I will get links posted on Facebook and on the web soon. It's like 190 pages. It's just to be clear, this is not a book version of the podcast. It's just the study questions and other resources. So it's basically the same material as what's available in print on the website, exploreatlasshrugged.com, which is also philosophyinaction.com/exploreas. Minus the podcast, so it's only the print information. If you do buy the book version, then you can access the online version, including the podcast, for half price. It's just $10, and also regular contributors can access the online version for free. And I will have some books at AtlasCon to sign too. And in fact, I probably need to send Jen Casey an email, or at least the AtlasCon organizers. She's in the chat this morning. That's why I thought of her about setting that up and making sure we can. Anyway, so that's the news about Explore Atlas Shrugged. I've got a bunch of updating and announcements to get done now that Amazon has those books available on their website. Secondly, okay. I resumed my series of podcasts on philosophy of religion. These are called the Religion Cast. And what I'm doing, for those of you who haven't heard yet, is the first eight in this series were free. I mean, I did almost all of them back in like 2009, 2010. But this next set of eight are going to be premium content. And what that means is that you can access these podcasts in one of three ways. You can listen to the live show for free. You can become a regular contributor, and then you get free access. Or you can pay $10 for the whole series of podcasts. In other words, for all eight of these premium podcasts. It's not $10 per podcast. So you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/religioncast. You can learn more about the series, learn what's coming up. I'm super excited about some of the topics that are coming up, particularly the problem of evil, Pascal's wager. Got three podcasts scheduled on faith versus reason and how that plays into arguments about the existence of God, and so on. So that's going to be. I'm excited to do that. I'm hoping to do basically one of these new episodes about every 2 to 3 weeks. So I want to get those done and out there. Three.
And by the way, I enjoyed those when you were doing them before, and I'm very happy that you're continuing them.
Yeah, me too. That was actually at the specific request of one of my regular contributors, because basically I had a bunch of stuff, you know, on my plate, like, what do I want to do? I've got a bunch of sort of projects that I wanted to get out there. And he was like, well, hey, why don't you do X? And I'm like, well, okay then. You know, X is what's going to happen. So if you're a regular contributor, you can absolutely make requests like that, and I will, you know, sometimes that'll bump something up to the top of my queue, or at least move it up. Third, as these announcements suggest, I'm moving to a vaguely quasi-subscription model with Philosophy in Action. Basically, what this means is that I'm going to be offering regular premium content, meaning content that's free to regular contributors and that others need to pay to access. And so basically, this is... It's the Sunday show is still going to be free and so on. In particular, anything that I do live is also free. But if you want to get the podcast after the fact, that's what's either going to cost you a little bit of money or you have to be a regular contributor. So now might be a really fabulous, excellent time to become a regular contributor. If you do that, I'm more than happy to pass along the access information for the Religion Cast, for my recent podcast that I posted that was actually my 2012 lecture on moral perfection, access to Explore Atlas Shrugged and so on. So you get a lot of benefits if you sign up as a regular contributor just right now. And you can do that. You can become a regular contributor over at philosophyinaction.com/support. Also, I am missing emails for just a few regular contributors. So if you do contribute regularly, but you haven't gotten emails from me with all of that secret login information for those podcasts, then please do email me. And there's a guy with the first name of Edward, and I'm thinking of you in particular. So let me know if that's you, because I don't have your email address. I think I think this person contributes via Dwala, and Dwala does not give me email addresses. Greg, did you have something to add?
I just want to throw in. Just wanted to mention that for anybody who's considering this, Diana's making it really easy because I've been watching this happen in the background. Emails show up explaining this awesome other stuff that she has available, and she has the access credentials and stuff, and the emails keep showing up. Here's another update with some other stuff. Here's another one with another stuff, and it accumulates. So it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, that's what I'm aiming for. So fourth announcement is there's going to be no radio show next Sunday for personal reasons. Basically, when I talked about needing to put May down for aggression issues, that's actually happening on Sunday morning. That was the only time that we could figure out to make that work with Paul being here and getting my fabulous, wonderful vet out to the house. So that's not going to happen on Sunday, A, because there's a time conflict, but B, because I will be a complete wreck, particularly because it's not just May that we have to put down, but my beloved cat, Elliot, who has right-sided heart failure and who is starting to do worse and worse. And if we don't put him down now, we risk, you know, if we try to keep him alive a little bit longer, we risk having him throw a clot, which would be an extremely painful way for him to die. And so I think that's really critical that we do the right thing now, even if that means potentially missing 6 months of his life. I think that's the kinder thing to do. Anyway, so that's it's going to be a really miserable day. But the good news is, as it so happens, all three of these questions turned out to be really, really substantial, and Greg was willing to go long today. He had time to do that. So we're gonna go really long. I think it's probably gonna be like an hour and a half long show. So to make
strap
up,
in, folks, it's gonna get big.
I know. So that's all the news. I don't know that I've ever had 8 minutes of news in the beginning, but I've been very productive. So that's that.
I think it's that's pretty impressive too. I need to take some notes from you on how to get all this stuff done.
Yeah, Andrew and I need to do our interview about what we're doing to make me ridiculously productive.
Oh yeah. So, looking forward to that.
Yeah.
All right. If nothing else, we can move on.
Absolutely.
The special seven virtues. What's so special about the seven virtues? Ayn Rand identified seven virtues: rationality, honesty, productiveness, independence, justice, integrity, and pride. What's different about those qualities as compared to other commonly touted virtues like benevolence, creative temperance, or courage? Basically, why are those seven virtues, the seven virtues in objectivism? Is objectivism right to single them out? Are they exhaustive? Well, I think it's obvious. Seven magic number, so
yeah.
You have to come up with seven.
Yeah.
No more, no less.
Yeah. Seven, it's prime. I mean, like, how could it not be perfect? So that actually does bring up a serious issue that I want to just give a little prelude about here. Philosophers, particularly philosophers of the rationalist sort, meaning people that are philosophers that are focused on the connections between ideas rather than the correspondence of their ideas to reality. These kinds of philosophers, and philosophers tend to be rationalists, but particularly some of the really bad ones, they really, really like symmetry. And the classic case of this, the case that I always think of when I think of wanting this kind of symmetry and completeness and everything to be very, very conceptually neat and tidy, is Immanuel Kant's Table of Judgments. So this is a table of concepts of pure understanding. So his idea here is that these concepts are not derived from experience, but they're actually innate. And without these concepts, we would be unable to even think about empirical stuff. They're the precondition of thought about empirical matters. And this table of judgment consists of 12 of these categories. and they are ever so neatly arranged into four groups of three categories. So we have, for example, three categories related to quantity. We have universal, particular, and singular. And we have three categories of quality: affirmative, negative, and universal, and so on. Right? There's two other subheaders, I guess. And
it's
and
like the
three
periodic
other.
Table of thinking stuff.
I know.
Except it's not really based in reality.
Yeah, and some of these groupings, like, there's sometimes where you go, okay, like, I make sense, it makes sense that there's three. And others, you're like, what? What do you, like, you just added something in there, Kant, just to get three out of that. I mean, he's basically,
yeah, had that three.
He's clearly fudging to get that symmetry, right? That somehow, you know, like, this construction of the mind has to be this perfectly symmetrical grouping. It's ridiculous. It is silly, right? So if you are thinking, if you're doing that kind of thing, if you are aiming for symmetry and order and completeness when thinking about philosophy, it's a really good sign that you have gone wrong. And this is particularly true in the very, very human, very messy topic of ethics. So beware of that kind of impulse of wanting to be complete and neat and tidy and exhaustive and so on when you're thinking about things like the virtues. Now, I don't think that's what the questioner is doing here. I want to be clear. But I think it's something to take note of in yourself if that's something that you're looking for when thinking about the virtues. Now, happily, that was not what Ayn Rand was doing at all. Unlike Kant, she was not concerned to be exhaustive and symmetrical and neat and tidy. And in fact, one of the really interesting things that you see, something that's always been a kind of puzzle to people interested in the objectivist ethics, is that she actually has two different conceptual structures in her two major discussions of the ethics. So in Galt's speech of Atlas Shrugged and in the objectivist ethics, which is in the Virtue of Selfishness. And Greg, I want you to read these two quotes, first from Galt's speech, since that's chronologically the first one, and then the objectivist ethics quote.
Okay. A little bit of a reading from Ayn Rand. Okay, first there's in Galt's speech, quote, "To live, man must hold three things as the supreme and ruling virtue values of his life: reason, purpose, self-esteem. Reason as his only tool of knowledge, purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve, self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means is worthy of living. These three values imply and require all of man's virtues, and all of his virtues pertain to the relation of existence and consciousness, rationality, independence, integrity, honesty, justice, productiveness, and pride."
So just one note about this. Then she goes on in this relevant section of Galt's speech to discuss each of these virtues in a paragraph, right? But you can see all of them are sort of on a par in a way. So anyway, next quote from the objectivist ethics.
So then, from another perspective, in ITOE, the Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology.
No, Greg.
Sorry,
this is from the objectivist ethics.
Yeah. Quote, "The three cardinal values of the objectivist ethics, the three values which together are the means to and the realization of one's ultimate value, one's own life, are reason, purpose, self-esteem, with their three corresponding virtues, rationality, productiveness, pride. Productive work is the central purpose of a rational man's life, the central value that integrates and determines the hierarchy of all his other values. Reason is the source, the precondition of his productive. Pride is the result." Unquote.
Then
she goes on.
She goes on to discuss rationality, productiveness, and pride, and the other virtues, independence, integrity, honesty, and justice, are just one sentence aspects of rationality. That's a bit of a different structure there, right? The basic content is the same. These are the three major values. These are the three, or these are the seven virtues. But there's a different kind of structure there. Now, what's interesting is I don't think that this is an advance in her thinking about the virtues. Leonard Peikoff in Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand, uses the basic structure from Galt's speech. You know, rationality is the head virtue, and all the others are aspects of rationality. But I think the key point that I want to make here is that Ayn Rand wasn't concerned to make the virtues exhaustive and symmetrical. She wasn't concerned to make them neat and tidy. She wasn't concerned with this, how is it that we, you know, this rationalist structuring of the virtues. what I think that she was aiming to do was offer very clear and useful guidance. Now, sure, I wish that she had said more about why she chose these virtues and didn't include others. I particularly wish she had said more about these three major values, which it's interesting to try to look at the literature and see the attempt struck these. I don't have any grand view about them, but I mean, I think obviously they're important, but why these three? Why were these chosen? What do they really mean? How should they be integrated into our thinking about day-to-day choices? Have any great views on? Somebody would have to submit a question to the queue for me to figure that out. Basically, she didn't, right? She didn't explain this. She didn't explain why she chose these seven virtues. And so what we have to do here is just reflect on them and reconstruct. And I think that here, the contrast with moral amplifiers, which is a concept that I've developed, is really, really important and hugely, hugely useful.
Yeah. All right. So can you start with talking about what makes these seven virtues unique?
Yes. So here I'm going to leave aside productiveness to start off with. We'll talk about it later. And the reason I'm leaving it aside is because it's a bit of an anomaly, which is interesting and odd. Okay, so first of all, I think there's two basic features that these seven, or let's talk about just six virtues have. One, they provide crucial fundamental guidance in our lives, and two, they are contextual absolutes. So first of all, these virtues provide crucial fundamental guidance for our choices in how we live our lives. They apply in a wide variety of circumstances, so they apply to work and family and romance and friendship and hobbies, pretty much anything and everything that you do. They are relevant in most circumstances, even if you might not actively think about them because they're so well ingrained. So, for example, imagine that you want to go ask your boss for a raise. Well, you can actually connect that request to every single one of the virtues. You can say, well, look, I need to make sure that I'm rational. Is this request made based on facts, based on my value to the company, or is it just that I want more money? It's relevant to honesty. You shouldn't be deceiving yourself or your boss about the quality of your work and your value to the company. You should be independent. You shouldn't ask for this raise or not based on your coworker's advice or how much your coworker earns. You should be just. You should consider whether you deserve this raise or not. You should be sure to be just to your boss in asking for the raise. You should have integrity. You should not judge that you deserve the raise and then refuse to act on that knowledge. You should have pride. Let's say asking for this raise is difficult. Well, you know, now might be the time to stretch yourself on a little bit of assertiveness. So we see that all of these virtues are relevant. And we also see that the virtues provide guidance on precisely the point where people really do need guidance. Because we can look and see, wow, people routinely act irrationally. They routinely do harm to themselves and others because they fail in these very points. They are dishonest. They are second-handed. They are unjust, and so on. So the virtues are going to shine a spotlight on those areas and remind us of what a better course is in life. So that's really important. Okay, so that's this function of the virtues is providing crucial fundamental guidance in our lives. The second point is that the virtues, when they're properly understood, are contextual absolutes, meaning that they always apply within their appropriate context. And basically this means so long as it's not an emergency, although even in cases of emergency, as we've talked about recently, most of these virtues still apply. But this is hugely important because what that means as contextual absolutes, it means that these virtues offer pretty darn clear guidance. And that helps make ethics into something more like a science rather than a just kind of vague judgment call. And the contrast to make here is between virtues and moral amplifiers. And moral amplifiers are things like perseverance, openness, generosity, and so on. These are qualities of character that a person ought to cultivate as qualities of character, but then has to deploy selectively based on the context, based on their suitability to the particular circumstances. Because sometimes these qualities are beneficial and sometimes they are harmful. You can listen to the podcast of my lecture from AtlasCon for more details on this topic. There's a lot of sort of interesting things to say about these things, about moral amplifiers. And these moral amplifiers, they are useful. It's actually really important to identify these and think about these and cultivate these quality of characters. But they are difficult to apply well. It really is a judgment call. It's based on experience. And there's also moral optionality in when they're deployed and how they're deployed and so on. Now, throughout the history of ethics, moral amplifiers and virtues are all just mixed up, right? All these qualities of character, they're called virtues. They're treated as moral amplifiers. It's just there's not a clear distinction between virtues and moral amplifiers. And the terminology here doesn't matter, but simply the fact that all of these things, these things that one should do all the time versus the things that are qualities of character that you wish to deploy selectively, these are all just treated as one and the same thing. And this is true in Aristotle, for example. Most of his virtues are actually moral amplifiers. But what's interesting is that he did notice that justice is different. He noticed that justice is an absolute. Like, it's not about doing it's not about doing it at the right time, in the right place, in the right way, and so on, in the way that other virtues for him are, like temperance. And what's different about Ayn Rand's virtues is that they are not moral amplifiers. These are true virtues. They are contextual absolutes. They are recognitions of and commitments to act according to fundamental facts. And that means that they provide far, far more clear guidance about what the right thing to do is than moral amplifiers do. And I think that's really, really, really important.
Okay, nice. All right, now, are Rand's virtues the only virtues?
Yeah, this is actually a really interesting question. So when I was preparing my lecture on moral amplifiers, I went online and looked up lists of virtues. And what was interesting is that none of those things qualified as virtues. They were all moral amplifiers based on the distinction that I'm drawing there. And basically, I've yet to find any of these common virtues. And there's hundreds of them that you can list that you can say, yeah, that's quality of character you'd want to have, but you'd need to deploy this selectively. This is not a contextual absolute. So I have yet to find any that are actual, anything else that's an actual virtue. Now, maybe that's just because we need to conceptualize these concepts more clearly. So, for example, take the case of independence. You could imagine a kind of loosey-goosey, vague definition that would make it into a moral amplifier. You could say, well, look, sometimes you want to go along with what other people say and accommodate them, but sometimes you just have to go do your own thing. And that's so independence would be, that's what independence is, and it's about your willingness to go with others or go your own way. And that would be, if you conceptualize it that way, it's definitely a moral amplifier and not a virtue. Whereas Ayn Rand, I think, was very clear, very conceptually clear about what her virtues were. And that lends them to being contextual absolutes because they are recognitions of fundamental facts. So maybe if you did a whole lot of work that way, you could find more virtues in these lists of moral amplifiers. Now, interestingly, I used to think that courage was a minor virtue. In other words, it was a virtue, but it was a species of integrity. It was only applicable in more limited contexts when your values are under threat, so you're feeling fear, and courage is the virtue that would be required to overcome that. But I now see this actually looking at it, the moment actually both Greg and I, we were in our production meeting thinking about this, and we both immediately agreed, no, this is a moral amplifier. Because it is, yes, it's great. Yeah. It's great to be courageous in the service of a good cause, but it's really bad to be courageous in the service of a bad cause. You could think about, there were lots of German soldiers in World War II who were extremely courageous, but that wasn't, all in all, that was actually the morally wrong thing for them to do. It's actually if you're fighting for the Nazis, it's way better to be a coward than to be a courageous soldier. So and the same is true for qualities like temperance and creativity and benevolence. These are moral amplifiers and not virtues. Okay, so basically to sum up here, Ayn Rand's seven virtues, they provide crucial fundamental guidance, and these virtues are contextual absolutes. They are not the be-all end-all in ethics, but they are hugely important. I think they are different in kind from moral amplifiers. And I just don't know any other plausible candidates for virtues. There's lots of important moral amplifiers that are worth discussing and cultivating and so on, but I have yet to see the virtue.
Yeah. And I don't remember where, but I do remember Peacock reporting that he had some rationalist tendencies, and he was rather taken with the idea of is this exhaustive? Is this complete? Is this systematic? And Rand told him, well, no, this is just a list that we've noticed of things where we can go astray and we need guidance.
Right.
So maybe in the future there could be others. It's hard to imagine right. it right now.
It's interesting.
Not exhaustively.
Because I've always disliked, by the way, I'm getting a bad echo, Greg, when you're not muted. Sorry. I've always really disliked Rand's definition of virtues in terms of the recognition of the fact that blah, blah, blah. And I always was much more drawn to Aristotle's focus on character and qualities of character and so on. But now I actually see if these virtues are contextually absolute, these are recognitions of fundamental facts, and putting them in those terms helps make clear what the contextual absolute is there. Whereas for moral amplifiers, yes, those make sense to talk about in terms of dispositions and character and qualities of character and so on. So, I mean, I think that this has given me a much greater appreciation. Thinking about moral amplifiers, thinking about the difference between bad and virtues has given me much greater appreciation for what Ayn Rand has done with her virtues and how revolutionary this is.
Nice. And now you mentioned the anomaly of productiveness. What's different about that?
Yes. So the virtue of productiveness, this is the commitment to creating the material values that are required for life. This satisfies the first criterion of providing crucial fundamental guidance for our everyday choices and actions and so on. But the problem seems to be that it's not contextually absolute. It's not always true that when there's an opportunity to be productive, a person ought to be so. And as a result of this, this is a difference that actually really matters, because people who are interested in Ayn Rand's philosophy, people who are interested in her egoistic ethics, have this set of questions about the requirements of productiveness, which are all of a similar type and all stem from, my gosh, is productiveness basically a contextual absolute? So these questions are things like, well, should a person ever retire or take significant time off of work? Does productiveness require me to maximize my income? Does raising kids and other non-remunerative work count as productive? Are vacations only justified by their positive effect on my production? And other similar questions. These are basically all questions about of the sort, oh my gosh, I'm not treating productiveness as a contextual absolute. Is this wrong? Or how can it possibly be that productiveness would be a contextual absolute in this way? This seems completely wrong. So these questions, they arise because productiveness is not like the other virtues. And unfortunately, that's not clear from Ayn Rand's discussions of it. And so people, these kind of questions naturally come up. So it's true, yes, a person ought always be rational and just and independent, but a person should not always be productive. That's not even possible, and it's certainly not good. It would be really, really horrible for one's well-being if basically one lived to produce rather than produce to live. Now, I used to think, my standard line about this, because I've been thinking about this issue for a number of years, I used to think that the relevant contextual absolute, meaning the virtue in the full sense, was actually purposefulness. A person's actions ought always be goal-directed, and for most people, productive work is a person's primary purposeful activity. But other activities, things like cleaning house, playing piano, cooking, and so on, those count as purposeful too if they're done correctly, meaning if they're done in this goal-directed, deliberate kind of way. But my view was that Ayn Rand selected productiveness rather than purposefulness as the virtue, because life requires production. Life requires the creation of material values, not just goal-directed activity. And too many people, too many intellectuals through history, too many philosophers, including Aristotle, they devalue productive work. And Ayn Rand wanted to emphasize and exalt productive work, and so that's why she chose that as the relevant virtue. But upon reflection, again, in light of the work that I've done on moral amplifiers, this is not a good explanation anymore. Purposefulness is actually a moral amplifier. It's not a virtue. After all, many people are deeply animated by purposes that are destructive to themselves and others, like spreading religion. There's lots of people who have that as a major purpose. Thinking about this just on the fly now, I don't know, would you count that activity, like would you count the activity of the priest as productive activity? I think there's a difference between being productive and earning an income, and you can make that distinction, yeah. But with purposefulness, I don't think you can make that distinction. Greg, did you have something you wanted to add?
Well, no, you might go along the lines of, look, productiveness in the sense of actually furthering your human existence.
Right.
And that other stuff doesn't count. That's kind of muddying the waters and mucking things up rather than furthering it.
Right. But I do think it's cheating to say. By the way, I've got the echo again, Greg. Sorry, Greg is having to be very silent today. sorry, Greg. I do think it's cheating, basically, to say that some activity only counts as purposeful if it's life-serving. Because if you do that, you could do that with every single moral amplifier, and then every moral amplifier would become a virtue. But it doesn't actually solve the practical problem. It's a purely semantic distinction then, and you're still left struggling with the question of, is this goal-directed activity life-serving or not? And you're only just framing it a different way. You're asking whether it's purposeful or not, as opposed to asking whether the purposeful activity is life-serving or not. So that doesn't really help. That's not clarifying. With productiveness, not productivity. Productivity is not a virtue. That's a moral amplifier. With productiveness, I do think that it's about creating the material values required to live, and there's a built-in life-serving aspect of that you can only get in purposefulness if you artificially shove it in there. Anyway, so as you can see, I have uncertainty about these kinds of issues. I think there's things to be worked out here. I don't think productiveness itself is a moral amplifier. It's not a quality of character that you're deploying or not, depending on circumstances. So I'm not quite sure what to think of it at this point. Maybe it just has a much more delimited context, or there's something else going on. I'm just really not sure. For now, I'm leaving this as an open question, and it's something that I plan to think over for the next, few months, maybe a few years, and maybe I'll come to some conclusions about that. And I have been thinking about this for quite some time, particularly since a review that I wrote of Ayn Rand's normative ethics for the objective standard. And this was one of my criticisms of the book, was that she did not, Tara Smith, I mean, I love this book. It's really amazing. Highly, highly recommended if you want to learn about the virtues and what they require in actual real life. But she didn't deal with this particular kind of issue. And there's difficulties, there's awkwardnesses in her discussion of productiveness because of this very issue. Craig Biddle unfortunately cut out my comments on this topic. I mean, I think he did it for rational reasons, but still it was unfortunate that they weren't ever published. I don't believe I've ever published them, but I will post them to Noodle Food. And again, I don't think I agree now with all that I said in that, but I think that gives a more detailed explanation of what I think the problem is.
Right. Very interesting. What's the take-home point?
So Ayn Rand was not concerned that her virtues be exhaustive, but the seven major virtues of the objectivist ethics are identified as that because they provide crucial fundamental guidance for our choices and because they're contextual absolutes. Productiveness is an anomaly with respect to the latter criteria, and we just sort of have to live with that for now. Sorry.
Well, that just that really mucks up my need to have a magic number.
And, I know. Yeah.
And nice, clean categories. All right. So a little bit of follow-up action. Andrew asks, why is honesty not a moral amplifier if there are caveats for when one should be honest? The kidnapper asking where the children are, for example.
Because I think that's a matter of the context. I think honesty is a contextual absolute. Particularly, honesty is actually primarily focused on, well, it's not primarily, but one of the major aspects of honesty. There's honesty to oneself and honesty to others. And certainly Rand would say, and I would agree with her, that not lying to yourself is far, far more important than not lying to other people. And there is no circumstance in which lying to yourself is justified. It doesn't matter if the kidnapper has your children. In fact, in that case, you'd really better not be lying to yourself in that case, because that's going to not result in very good outcomes. As for honesty with other people, there are a few very, very delimited contexts in which it's morally acceptable to lie. And that's pretty much basically just when other people are using force against you. Now, my view here is not universally held in objectivist circles. Leonard Peikoff certainly thinks it's okay to lie for the sake of privacy. and lie to your landlord if this has came up in understanding objectivism. It's okay to let's say if your landlord is a Orthodox Jew and he doesn't want any pork products in the apartment that you're renting from him, he believes that it's okay to lie and agree not to cook any pork products and then actually go ahead and do that. I don't recall if that's his specific example, but it was a landlord renter kind of case of that sort. I think that's actually really, really wrong. I think that's really, really, really wrong. So there's all kinds of exceptions that he would make that I'm not making. Now, maybe he would think honesty to other people is a moral amplifier. I don't know that it would qualify as that. It would just be a kind of weird heuristic then. But I actually think it's a virtue. I don't think you should be lying in those kind of cases. I don't think you should be lying to protect your privacy. And
yeah. So on this front, there's a parallel. So one, I would say, it's nonetheless the case that 100% of the time, you need to always regard understanding reality as important and faking it as not important, as bad, because all your values come from reality, not from some alternate reality that doesn't exist.
It's where I keep all my stuff.
Yeah, it's where we keep all our stuff. And here, there's kind of a parallel to physical violence. Like, okay, I do not go around punching people in the face. That's really inappropriate. That's an initiation of force is not just immoral, but actually evil. But nonetheless, there are circumstances where I would punch someone in the face, and that is when they're actually physically aggressing against me and I'm defending myself. So
right.
Physical self-defense. And the lying to somebody would be a direct parallel for me. Someone is physically aggressing against me, and much like I would not normally hit someone ever, I would not normally lie to someone ever, except if they're physically aggressing against me and I'm acting in self-defense.
Right. It's the kinder, simpler way of defending yourself as opposed to resorting to physical violence.
I don't need to pull the gun on the Nazi. I can just say there are no children here in the house.
Yeah, I generally don't like how people talk about this particular issue. It's about there being these exceptions to honesty and so on. No, there's something else going on again, which I haven't quite identified. I do think that there's this general principle of you do not allow evil to use your virtue against you. And I think that that's actually an aspect of justice and so on. And there's a self-defense issue here, but it's not as if there's all these exceptions for the virtues all over the place. No, there's actually a very delimited context in which, no, you don't owe this person honesty because they're using force against you. And that's pretty much it. And even as we saw, in cases of emergencies, your moral principles are still very much applying. I mean, maybe a little bit differently than they would in ordinary life, but they're still very much applying. And you in an emergency abandon your moral principles, you are going to be in deep trouble.
And even in those cases, to kind of underscore what you're saying, even in those cases where I'm lying to the Nazi or punching the mugger because he's attacked me, there is never a moment when I'm ever thinking that faking reality is a way to get values. I'm not, never. And I'm never thinking that aggressing on someone is a way to get values, ever.
Right.
It's purely defense against somebody who's convinced that those ways are a good way.
Yep. Yes.
All right. So next up, we've got Tom asking, would it be helpful to make a distinction on the whole anomaly of productiveness? Would it be helpful to make a distinction between productiveness, acting in recognition of the fact, and productivity, the action of producing material goods?
I would say the way I tend to divide these. Hang on, I want to look. I need to look at a different place in the notes to see where you. I want to just look at this distinction again because I didn't quite get it clearly. It would be helpful to make a distinction between productiveness, acting and productivity, the action of producing material goods. I don't know. I'll have to think about that. I do. Here's how I tend to think of the difference between productiveness and productivity. So productiveness is the virtue in the sense that it's this engaging in the activity of creating the material values that support your life, that kind of thing. Productivity is actually being efficient in accomplishing what you want to accomplish. So which is how we tend to use the term. Right? It doesn't matter whether you're a internet tech guru or a priest, you can be your productivity in terms of getting accomplished what you wish to get accomplished in, you know, a reasonable period of time with as few resources as you can, very efficiently, that can be going on or not. And all of those books that we have about productivity are about that kind of thing. They are not about having, you know, this life-serving career that's creating material values to required to live. That's there's the way we talk about productivity is that kind of, it's a kind of efficiency. Whereas the virtue of productiveness steps back and looks at the philosophical significance of what you're doing and why it serves your life.
Oh, man. You know, someone needs to put this in a queue because then we would work it over. It would be great.
I need to work on these issues. And also on the honesty issue, that would be a really good one for somebody to put in the queue. I need to work through these. In particular, if I would like to write about moral amplifiers and the relationship between personality theory and ethics and so on. And if I'm going to do that, I actually really do need this productiveness issue hammered out. So you all would be doing me a big service if you help me by submitting that to the queue.
You're on task, Tom, to get it into the queue. I'll vote it up. All right. So a little bit more on this. Jen Casey asks, if purposefulness isn't one of the virtues, then what does that mean for the idea of a central purpose, which, you know, Rand was listing as a big deal?
Well, her view is that productiveness is what correlates with the central purpose. So if I guess I'll reframe this question. If productiveness isn't one of the virtues, well, I do think it's one of the virtues. I don't quite know how to fit it into the conceptual scheme in a way. I have questions about central purposes too. And you all are familiar with that. I've answered a bunch of questions on central purpose, and I think I've gone back and forth a little bit about how important I think this is, and so I think those questions are all of a piece with the questions that I have about the place of productiveness as a virtue in the objective ethics. So what can I say?
It's a murky area.
I know.
Work on it.
I know.
And it's not just murky for you. I remember reading Ayn Rand's Normative Ethics, and fantastic book, also highly recommended. And I remember the anomaly going by, and it's like, something's off, and I can see her toying with it, but it's not becoming clear here.
Right.
So, all right, if nothing else, hey, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
Woo, yeah. So, Philosophy in Action Radio, not just live show, but the podcast too, at least the non-premium stuff, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide, and we do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners. But we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. And you can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, we really appreciate that regular support, and you get free access to all of our premium content. Again, you can do that over at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Signs of repression. What are the signs of emotional repression? It's very important not to repress your emotions, especially if you are a person with rationalistic tendencies. But how might a person identify when he's repressing some emotions? What are the signs? What can be done to avoid and overcome the tendency to repress if such a tendency has become habitual?
Good question. I like this one.
Yeah.
So we've got a clear place to start here. We need to figure out what repression is. So in Psychology of Self-Esteem, this is the book that Nathaniel Brandon wrote under Ayn Rand's auspices and then published shortly after their break. And so I would consider it fairly canonical as far as objectivist views go. Nathaniel Brandon, he defined repression as, quote, a subconscious mental process that forbids certain ideas, memories, identifications, and evaluations to enter conscious awareness, close quote. And then he clarifies, he says, quote, repression is an automatized avoidance reaction whereby a man's focal awareness is involuntarily pulled away from any forbidden material emerging from less conscious levels of his mind or from his subconscious, close quote. So let's talk about a couple of examples because I think that'll make things more clear. Imagine a woman who's unsatisfied in her marriage, but she panics at the thought of being alone without this cushy lifestyle, let's say, that's provided by her husband. So with every negative thought that she has about her marriage, every time she runs into one of those circumstances where she's like, oh, this I don't like, she pushes aside that thought with, of course I'm happy. Like, look at how good my life is. I can't, you know, it's not even worth thinking about this. That's repression, particularly when it becomes automatized. That's what repression is. And the problem here is not just that that this wife will never leave her husband. Maybe that's not necessary, right? But the issue here is that the problems in their marriage will never, ever be addressed because she can't even face them squarely. She can't even recognize what they are. Here's another example. A man resents his officious, interfering mother, but he's a Christian, and so honoring his father and mother is part of his moral ideal. That's part of what he regards as his moral obligation. So whenever he feels this burst of hatred at her meddling, pushes that emotion away, he pushes that thought, that feeling away as wrong and ungrateful and selfish and cruel and ungodly and so on. And particularly once that becomes automatized, that's repression. And so as a result, this man is going to allow his mother to rule his life despite his hatred of that. He will never put their relationship on a healthier footing, and he will make a bunch of bad decisions solely so to satisfy her, not because that's the right thing to do. So that's basically what repression is. And it's useful here, I think it's actually really important, to contrast repression with suppression. So suppression is the conscious, deliberate process of refusing to focus on certain facts or emotions at a particular moment or a particular slice in time in order to direct your conscious awareness elsewhere, where it's actually really needed. So this is oftentimes perfectly rational. So let's say you're a student, you need to study for your exam, but you just met this like really amazing girl in the coffee shop, and all you want to do is think about her, right? You might have to go, okay, brain, let's set that aside for now. Like, I know she's super interesting and really beautiful, and she's just everything that I could possibly ever want in a woman. Like, we just need to set that aside because the exam has to be studied for. Like, that's coming up. That's what's actually really urgent here. And that would be an act of suppression, but there's a difference between that, where it's conscious and deliberate and you're going to set it aside and allow yourself to think about it later, versus when you're going, I just can't think about that ever. No, no, no. And that's
your subconscious is saying, la, 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 la. We are fine. We are fine. So what you're talking about is the distinction between the conscious training you're giving your subconscious and the subconscious results of that training.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, suppression is how you train repression.
Yes, but there's a lot of suppression that's really good and perfectly rational. So.
Oh, yeah. So you just want to do it very carefully.
In fact, suppression is a skill that you need to have because brains are not always good about thinking about the most appropriate thing at the moment.
Exactly. All right, so how is repression related to rationalism?
Yeah, so the questioner said the following, quote, "It is very important not to repress your emotions, especially if you are a person with rationalistic tendencies." So, close quote. So rationalism, once again, this is somebody who is, the person who's a rationalist is somebody who's focused on connections between ideas rather than on the connection between the ideas and reality. So they're looking for pie-in-the-sky systems rather than hard-hitting facts. This quote,
yeah.
It's important not to repress.
Categories of 4x3, yeah.
Yeah. So this quote, it's important not to repress your emotions, especially if you're a person with rationalistic tendencies. This is not accurate as stated. The fact is nobody should ever, ever, ever repress their emotions. This repression is always bad. Now, this is an error that rationalists are particularly inclined to make. I think that's what the questioner was trying to get out. And the reason is that rationalists, they are focused on abstractions apart from concretes, and they're often deeply uncomfortable with emotions. They're often deeply uncomfortable with their bodies, and emotions are felt in the body, and they're not really under your control, and they're not this pure abstract thought. And so, oh, God, these are really uncomfortable, is what the rationalist says.
And also, it's like, I know the truth of what's good for me, and yet I'm totally miserable doing it. That's okay, la, la, la. I know this is the right thing to do, so do it anyway.
Right. Yeah, so when you take somebody who's uncomfortable with emotions to begin with, and then you put them in situations or they have experiences in which their emotions clash with their judgments. And so their emotions seem wrong, they seem unsuitable, and they seem to be interfering with them doing the right thing. And so their reaction is to repress those emotions, oftentimes. And then as a result, those emotions actually just get more and more wacky. And so the person has to repress more in order to keep them at bay. And so you can get a really vicious cycle here of wacky emotions and repression and wacky emotions and repression.
Probably the kind of stuff that therapists get to see a lot of interesting cases of.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So what are the signs of repression?
Well, I will say this is not my forte in that I tend towards the opposite error. I tend towards emotionalism, not repression. I mean, I tend towards being perhaps a little bit too free with my emotions and letting them out and airing them out in ways that are not always wise. Repression is just like, it's not mine.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But I do know the signs. They're not hard to identify. And even, I will say, even as somebody who tends towards that emotionalism, repression is still an issue, and it's still something that I need to watch out for. So just even if you are like me, you tend towards the emotionalist side, don't think that, oh, well, I can stop listening now because I would never do this. No, you might. Given enough kind of pressure, this might be something that that you end up doing, and you would be all the worse for it. Okay, so sign. One, denying the reality of emotion. I'm not angry, right? No.
He says angrily. Yeah.
Pushing thoughts out of your head because they are too painful or too unpleasant, right? Saying things to yourself like, I just can't think this. I cannot think that, it's just too horrible. Condemning yourself for an emotion. Saying, I can't feel this way. It would be so wrong. I would be such a horrible person if I felt this way. Focusing on the disaster that would supposedly happen if you feel some way or if you did something, right? I just can't think about how much I resent my mother. If I you know, never talk to her again like I want to right now, the whole family would hate me, right? And it's just this, it's not a reasoned analysis here. It's this like, oh God, no, kind of reaction. Another sign of repression is that is not a sign of repressioning happening at the moment, which is what these other signs are, but it's the one of the effects of repression is emotions that pop out of nowhere and bowl you over, right? So you are, you know, you're going about your day and things are reasonable and everything seems fine, and then some little thing happens and you blow your stack and you go, wow, like where the hell did that come from? That was really, really scary. And hopefully you haven't repressed, hopefully you haven't evaded that or repressed that. So I think that if you see any of these kinds of signs, you need to stop, like full stop, breaks, time to introspect. You need to look really carefully. And this should be part of the kind of background introspection thread that Greg, you're always talking about, you're always advocating. So Greg, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, this is our standard thing, introspect. I'm always looking for these anomalies, and it could be that's why I'm also, this is not, repression is not my thing. We in the prep meeting, you were like, okay, so any examples of this from your background? And I'm like, no, that's just not the way my mind rolls, because it could be just because of my personality type just got me on the right track here, or I'm really good at repressing it, but I doubt that. I'm always looking for these little anomalies, though, of where my spidey sense says something's a little off, like, if I have an emotion that hits me out of nowhere, that's a red flag. I go, man, where'd that come from? In general, the normal, which I'm used to, is I have a pretty good idea of why I'm feeling what I'm feeling at any given time. And if I can't tell, that's my red flag to go and look for is that a reasonable feeling? Does this have any basis in what I know? Or did something just go sideways? So if that last thing you talked about happened to me, for example, of being bowled over by a huge emotion that was triggered by something not significant, I would be stopped in my tracks. I'd be like, whoa, okay, one, don't act on it. Don't know why that came about. And two, it's like, what the hell's going on here? And in general, introspection's really, really handy. And I gather this is a little unique for objectivists tend to be more introspective than most people, because we know this technology for, hey, your conscious decisions train your subconscious mind. So you should be watching your subconscious actions for signs of mistraining. Yep. And keep the training up all the time. Reinforce the good stuff and de-enforce the bad stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and so I think it's really important when you notice any of these signs, I mean, A, to have that introspective thread going all the time, you know, the red flag pops up. You need to give yourself this order to, okay, so I'm not going to push these thoughts and emotions away. I'm just going to allow myself to feel and think, and I'm going to allow myself to do this without judgment. I think this is actually really important. You need to be a kind person. You need to just be an observer and a friend to yourself, not a disciplinarian. Like, don't worry about, like, well, that's not rational, that's not right. Just, like, set all that aside. And if you do that consistently, you will realize that the world will not end and you will not explode if you think and feel these forbidden thoughts. Because you have to actually have the thoughts and allow them to develop before you can then judge them and judge whether they're rational or not, judge whether they're you know, morally correct or not. You have to allow them to develop before you judge them.
Yeah, you can't diagnose something you can't see.
Right.
And the attitude, one attitude that you might use is, okay, remember, your subconscious, it's just like it's an otherwise helpful, happy, say, puppy dog. It really does want to do what you need it to do. It does it automatically. It's not like it's out to get you or anything like that. It's not another person. It's you. So the attitude you can have is like, oh, okay, I'm going to observe the training. It's like I may see that my puppy dog over there is malfunctioning, but I've got to stop and study what he's doing and why before I can retrain the puppy dog. You can't clamp down on him before you even figure out what's going wrong, because then you have no chance of retraining.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of the analogy that I would use is if and I've actually Greg, I'm getting the echo again, and it was so gone for a while. It was really nice. Sorry. Anyway, think about being in one of those self-defense training, like one of the houses, right, where you have good guys popping up at you, and you either have to, you know, you have to judge good guy or bad guy and then shoot or not shoot. The person who is repressing is basically everything that pops up, he's shooting. Right. Even like the mom holding the baby. This is not a good thing. You have to take that moment. And I think with thoughts and feelings, it has to be more than just a moment. It has to be a longer time to let those thoughts and feelings develop than just a second or two. But you have to do the identification. You have to let the facts present themselves to you before you judge them. And in general, I would say one of the attitudes that really, really helps me, and this is something I actually learned from Jimmy Wales way back in the day, was that you have to explicitly adopt the policy of allowing yourself to think and feel anything and everything without judgment. So I never, ever feel guilty for all the random crazy thoughts and emotions that pop into my brain. Like, my brain is weird. It thinks all kinds of crazy and sometimes horrible things. And this is not... This is okay, right? I wouldn't want to clamp down on that. If I clamped down on that, I would actually be doing myself really, really serious. And so my attitude towards these things, these crazy, ridiculous, stupid things that I think, is like, whatever, crazy brain, like, you're not the boss of me. You can think and feel what you like. By all means, like, throw that stuff up. That's fine. But when it comes time to actually say things and do things, rational Diana is going to be in charge. So bring it on, baby. Like, I got it. I got it handled, right? So I judge myself by my words, my ideas, by the actual thoughts that I embrace, by what I actually do, what I actually say.
Conscious actions are the ones that matter.
Yeah, not random fleeting thoughts and emotions. That's like, those are okay. Those can be as wild and crazy as they want, and I'm not going to think that that somehow reflects on me and who I am as a person and think that I'm going to have to act on them, because I don't. I just don't.
And the magical part of this is, by just lightening up a little, this goes with the growth mindset idea. Over time, well, the goofiness will happen less and less. It may be never entirely eliminated because, well, you are a human, and you get inputs and training that you sometimes don't notice. But
right.
I have a similar thing. I don't say it quite the same way you do. I just tell myself, goofy human, when I notice something that's automatic but not appropriate that I'm not going to act on because I don't know why or whatever, I just shrug and say, goofy human, we're going to have to look at that later. Mm-hmm. And after I've figured out what's really the appropriate action, it's like, hey, even stopping and saying goofy human, I'm not acting on that, that's training to my subconscious. Hey, that's got an asterisk next to it. And then later as I think about whatever was in fact goofy, if it was actually goofy, and I'm thinking the exact opposite and doing the exact opposite, I'm showing the hopeful puppy dog in my subconscious, no, this is what we're really going to do. And so in the future, now the puppy dog is going to do what he should do instead of that other thing.
Yep.
And in the meantime, I'll just be goofy human. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yep. No big deal. No big deal.
All right. What else you got?
That's it.
Oh, nice.
Right?
No,
yeah, take-home point.
Take-home point.
So repression is automatized refusal to think or feel that greatly impairs a person's capacity to solve the problems of his life. A person can look for signs of repression by constantly monitoring himself for signs of shutting down thoughts and feelings. He can overcome repression by allowing himself to think and feel everything, even while declining to act on random, goofy thoughts and feelings. And I just had one final thought that actually Star brought up in the chat. So she says, quote, "You have to balance useful introspection with obsession. Sometimes there isn't anything you can do to change the dynamics of a situation. You have to accept what the feeling and situation are and then put it aside," close quote. And I would agree with that completely. And what was really interesting was during our production meeting, Greg and I ended up talking about when we are uselessly spinning on a topic. Because for us, this is the kind of thing that tends to happen that is not, you know, not good. And it's basically the flip side of repression. Instead of shoving something aside and saying, I won't talk about this. Yeah, it's going over the same ground over and over and over again. And so I would actually love if somebody would ask us a similar question to this one about that. But I do think this is one of the ways in which suppression is oftentimes a useful skill. You have to say about when you're in that mode, you have to recognize it and realize, look, I'm this situation just is what it is, and I'm not serving myself by continuing to mull over these feelings and so on. So I'm going to need to set this aside so I can, for example, get some work done or make dinner or whatever else it is that I'm trying to do. But there's a difference between that and going, I can't think about this. I'm not thinking about this. Oh my God, I'm such a horrible person if I think this. That isn't the right reaction to anything ever.
Yeah, and that is one of the interesting things in our discussion where that's a clear example I have of like spinning on someone who's done something terrible to us or someone being wrong on the internet or whatever, the breakup you had with someone, or there's lots of examples where in the past I've just noticed it's like, oh, I think I'm too focused on this. It's not productive to keep spinning like this. Okay, I'm just going to set it aside. Otherwise, it'll exhaust me and stop me from doing what I need to do. And that's definitely the kind of decision where you want to be careful about what are you training yourself to do? And here it would be, I'm not training myself to obsess on this, to be angry all the time about this or whatever.
Right.
So, yeah, very good points. A little bit of follow-up action. Let's see. Andrew asks, do you have any principles for parents training children to engage their emotions and not to repress?
So there is, as Jen replied in the chat, there's a million things that you could say about this. I would actually mention one thing that I know is talked about in positive discipline circles, and that is, I think almost one of the most fundamental things you can do is help children identify what their emotions are. And this can start even before they're talking. Is to say, like, oh, it looks like you're feeling really sad about this as your kid is bawling to you about a lost toy or something like that. To help them identify, oh, here's the emotion, right? And to do it in this calm and quiet way, and never, ever, ever, I think, to be disciplining or punishing your children for their emotions, right? If you're the parent and your kid says, you know, I hate you, mommy, you're so mean, right? To be punishing that child for being rude to you is a really good way of encouraging repression, because those are then forbidden thoughts that it's wrong to have and you should not ever say them. I think that you can talk about whether that's a polite thing to say, or, you know, look, I understand that you're
no screaming at mommy.
Well, like, you know, look, I understand that you're frustrated, but let's find out a way to get out that frustration in a way that doesn't hurt my feelings. You know, like, I don't think you want to phrase it that way, but there's things of that kind that you can do. I think it's really important for parents to encourage their kids to identify their emotions and not be condemning those emotions themselves as wrong. There might be things that the child does with those emotions that are inappropriate that you can help redirect them in some more appropriate way. But I think that it's really, like you are setting up a kid for repression if there are certain things that they are not allowed to think or not allowed to feel or not allowed to say.
So, little Sally, it is okay to feel terrible about me, but it's not okay to scream at me.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
of that.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
And then we can talk about whether or not it was appropriate to feel so horrible about me. It's like, did I really hurt you that badly?
Well, I think just allow them to feel how they feel and maybe then talk about the situation and see if that helps change their feelings, right? Because I don't think that, like, directly, like, I I, as an adult, can directly attack my emotions and go, Diana, is that reasonable? I don't know that that's the way to do it with other people. I think that what you need to do, both with other adults and other kids, is change their perhaps change their assessment of the situation, change their view of the facts, and allow the emotion to change as a result of that.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Sensible. Okay.
So, by the way, so Tom asked, can Jen call in at this number to tell us all of her million things? No, she can't, because we're already way over time, and we have totally not prepared for this. But if folks would be interested, and if Jen would be interested, I would love to do an interview on this. I think this would make a great topic, and I'm going to write down a note about
interview this. Time. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't. I need to resume doing interviews. Jen on emotions in kids, so I'll remember to do this. And Jen, I will ping you about that and see if you are interested in doing that.
Well, please say yes. That'd be really cool.
I know, really.
Yeah. All right. So, in the meantime, some of our listeners can't afford to contribute financially. Can they help out in some other way?
Yes. Any of you can help us promote the show by sharing our work on social media. You can share blog posts, upcoming events, and posted podcasts. That helps us promote the show to a wider audience, and every share really feels like a pat on the back to me. And, you know, if you're really pretty regular about that and you're poor, by all means, shoot me an email and say, hey, look, I love sharing your work, but I don't have any money. Could I get access to something that you really want access to? And I will be happy to do that.
Ethics of care for the body. What is the moral status of actions aimed at tending to one's body? In an egoistic ethics, the ultimate end of moral action is the growth and continuation of one's own life. Ayn Rand discussed many of the kinds of actions required to achieve this goal, but she didn't discuss matters of bodily care, such as cleaning your teeth, eating well, exercising regularly, tending to a wound, and seeking necessary medical care. These constitute a whole universe of actions necessary for the maintenance of one's body and hence one's life. Are such actions moral and virtuous? Should bodily care itself be considered a virtue, or are these actions already subsumed under the virtues? If so, I would love to know how to brush my teeth with integrity and pride. I like that part.
I love that lesson, and it's funny, but it's also true. It really is, and I'll tell you how in a minute. By all means, brush your teeth with integrity and pride, and Okay. So, properly understood, ethics is concerned to identify the kinds of values and actions required to live a happy, successful, flourishing life. It's concerned with your well-being as a human organism. And it's important to recognize in this respect that as a human organism, we are not minds that are barely tethered to bodies. We are creatures of united body and mind. Our minds and our bodies are so intertwined that the well-being of the mind depends on the well-being of the body, and the well-being of the body depends on the well-being of the mind. So absolutely, yes, by any rational, egoistic ethics, a person ought to care for his or her body as a moral matter. This is necessary for life. And an egoist ought to value his or her health, not just in terms of tending to the routine matters, but also pursuing more serious goals as well, you know, engaging in kind of projects, bodily projects.
Which leads to the question, do we need a distinct virtue for that?
No. In the same way that we don't need distinct virtues for personal versus professional relationships or pursuing work or, you know, having a career versus doing hobbies. Right? That's not how the virtues are divvied up. There's no need here for distinct virtues for cultivating and tending to the mind versus for the body. Instead, I do actually think that tending to the body, this can be best understood as forms of integrity and pride. And we might need to expand, we might need to broaden our understanding of the virtues just a little bit in order to do that, but it's not a stretch here at all. Now, I will say, from what I know of Ayn Rand as a person, her bodily health was not a priority for her. But we are not bound by her particular values or her idiosyncrasies, or I should say her mistakes, and I think that this was actually a mistake for her. It's obvious. It's obvious, despite like whatever her views are, that it's obvious that bodily health matters hugely to overall well-being, and it matters hugely to a person's longevity. And so we can and should update our understanding of the virtue to incorporate those facts. So let's talk about integrity here, first of all.
All right. So Rand wrote on integrity, quote, integrity is loyalty to one's convictions and values. It is the policy of acting in accordance with one's values, of expressing, upholding, and translating them into practical reality.
Yeah. So your body is or should be of great value to you. Its well-being is part and parcel of your overall well-being, including your mental health. And you ought to recognize that fact, and you ought to act in accordance with that fact. That would be a matter of integrity there. And that means, that implies that you shouldn't be abusing or neglecting your body, such as by routinely eating junk food or under-eating or being sedentary or ignoring signs of disease or subjecting yourself to overwhelming stress and so on. If you do these things, you will suffer and you may become, it's not just, you might not feel well. You might become permanently disabled, or at least disabled for a good long time, and you can die as a result. I certainly know people who, particularly from ignoring signs of disease and in general taking poor care of their health, have probably died decades sooner than they needed to because of that.
Yeah, and not enjoyed things on the way. And it's it's definitely an aspect of integrity, acting on what I know. It's kind of an engineering trade-off. You might really be working on honing your health and being like a fitness competitor or something like that, or you could be more like a normal person, but still, it does come down to the fact that when you abuse or neglect your body, you're not just optimizing, you're actively harming yourself.
Yeah, you're not just optimizing, you're actually harming.
For me, the cut line is, it's like, go ahead and optimize away, but you don't want to sabotage your own flourishing in some other way. And you could err in both directions on this. That's why it feels like an engineering trade-off.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that a person should optimize their health or their fitness, because, look, we all have other values competing for our time and our money and our effort. But my point is that a person should put in a reasonable amount of time and effort and money sufficient for maintaining reasonable bodily health. And to fail in that is a failure of integrity. And I'm not saying that. I'm not making it into a moral issue. I'm not saying it's a matter of virtue or vice to be judgmental. It's not so that I can go to the grocery store and be like, oh, that person has no integrity because they're fat. No, that's absolutely not what I'm saying here. I'm saying to underscore to yourself, hey, look, this is important. I need to think about this. I need to stop pretending that my bodily health doesn't matter. I need to feel connected to my body. This is actually important to me. This is part of who I am. And I think it's really important as a matter of integrity to want this integration between mind and body, to want to be a whole person, not just a mind or not just a body. You should want to feel connected to your body. You should want to feel deeply embedded in it. You should want to enjoy its capacities. And if you neglect it or abuse it, you're not going to feel that way. You need to tend your body. You need to notice it and value it and give it what it needs to function well if you are to feel that mind-body connection.
Yeah, the failure of integrity would be if you go around pretending like you're just a body or just a mind, well, you know or should know better. So you should not be acting that way.
Right.
There's a broad range of acceptable behavior in there, but just a mind or just a body is not in the broad range.
Right, and okay. I can understand why people get into that error. And if you're in that error, if that's how you think of yourself, and there was actually a really good article that I read recently about this woman who was shamed on the internet for being a fat person doing it wrong at the gym for something that was totally innocuous. And she talked about how difficult it was for her to overcome this view that she was just kind of a mind with this tenuous connection to the body. She was sort of tethered to this body. But to feel actually in her body that was a real accomplishment for her. That was a real shift in her thinking. And I just think, congratulations, kudos to you for doing that, because more than anything else, that is going to be what's important for getting you healthier, at whatever weight you are, but to help you live longer and healthier and enjoy your body.
Yeah, it was really tragic. It was like she was alienated from herself.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh,
absolutely,
man, that is seriously a malfunction. You can't have that.
Right.
All right. So then for pride, Rand said this about pride. Quote, pride is the recognition of the fact that you are your own highest value. And like all of man's values, it has to be earned. That of any achievements open to you, the one that makes all others possible is the creation of your own character.
Yeah. So Ayn Rand clearly focuses the virtue of pride on this need of cultivating your own moral character, of becoming the person of self-made soul. But I actually would propose that pride is better understood in a broader way as cultivating your whole person, mind and body, and that would include your moral character, but it would include more than that. So it would not merely reference moral ambition, but all kinds of personal ambition, meaning a desire to make yourself into a better person, to be more competent, more skilled, more knowledgeable in all the various important areas of your life. And I think a primary importance here is cultivating a growth mindset in pursuit of your values, meaning that you are embracing challenges, you are persisting despite difficulties, you are regarding effort as a path to improvement, you are welcoming useful feedback, and so on. And again, these are all the core elements of the growth mindset, which I have discussed in an interview with Kelly Elmore some months ago, and you can go back to the archives and go look that up. But obviously, like, having this growth mindset, that's actually really important for being a person of good moral character, but that's what's required for personal ambition in all areas of your life. And this should be done, cultivating this growth mindset should be something that's done in matters of your mind as well as matters of your body. So it should be done with respect to your education, your career, your friendships, your sports, or maybe your fitness goals or health issues, with respect to food, sex, etc. Having a growth mindset about all of these things is really important and really beneficial to your life. Now, I do think that there's a reasonable range of emphasis that a person can place on ambitions with respect to the body. Because it's different if you're a professional athlete or an amateur athlete versus if you're just a person who wants to stay healthy and fit. Like, this is a difference between Paul and I. I am an amateur athlete, and so a lot of the extra workouts that I've been doing lately are about making myself more fit for that. Paul is just looking to stay healthy and fit. And so, you know, his exercise routine is a bit different from mine, and that makes sense. So I'm not saying, like, here, you have to do these specific things or you should be in this kind of shape or something like that. All I'm saying is that your body should be on your personal growth agenda in some form. And what's interesting is, for me, this has actually been an area that I have really worked on, particularly in the last few years. In the last few years, I have generally been working on some health-related goal. And as a result of that, I'm in far, far better shape physically than I was in my 20s. And it was interesting because last year I had just sort of stopped having goals. I mean, I was still eating basically paleo and so on, but I'd just sort of gotten lax about everything. And I mean, I was still working out, but I didn't have any kind of purpose that I was going after. And what happened was, when I got Phantom and so I started riding two horses a day, I started getting much more tired, much more exhausted. And so I was fueling myself with more and more sugar, including peanut M&Ms, which are delicious.
no.
I know. And so it was actually, and I knew, like, sugar has always been my problem. That's always been my weakness. And it was actually getting really hard for me. I would stop at the, I'd be at the grocery store and I'd want to buy sugar, and I would be at the gas station, I'd want to buy sugar. And just that craving, that desire was there all the time again, which I had gotten rid of it when I went paleo. And so I was like, wow, this is just like, this sucks. This is horrible. And so back, when I was headed to Aiken, I decided to do a strict paleo again while I was there. And that really made a difference. Arthur was my accountability. And now actually I'm doing that. I took a break while we had snow. And now I'm doing low-carb paleo, which is even better. Like, all of those sugar cravings are now completely gone with low-carb, which is amazing and wonderful. And then I've also added more workouts so that I'm in better shape for riding. And so I'm feeling much better. I'm looking much better. And it hasn't been a ton of work, but I've gotten really, really great returns on it. And it's just interesting. It's just a good reminder for me that I need to be doing something active about this. I need to be pushing myself in some new way so that because otherwise I'm sliding backwards, right? I have to always be working on advancing. There's no such thing as stasis here, right? Like, either you're moving forward a little bit or you're getting lax. At least that's my experience. And Greg, you and Tammy are both crazy physically fit people, and you've done things like this in preparing, for example, for your Go Ruck challenge. I remember you talking about loading bricks.
Crazy physically. Well, she's crazy.
Loading bricks into your backpacks and taking hikes. That's pretty nuts.
Yeah. I do want to, before I talk about that, I want to underscore something that you just said, though. You don't accept stasis. I'm not passive about honing my character. I'm not passive about what I'm learning and developing in my career. And I'm not passive about my physical well-being either. So at the very least, I'm doing maintenance and reasonable reasonable stuff for my body, and that includes even when I'm not preparing for some event, some goofy thing where it's like, oh man, if we don't amp this up, we're going to get hurt. I'm still going to CrossFit, and importantly, that's fun. It's the reason we do that is it's fun. It helps us do it. But on occasion we do prep for things like this GORUCK challenge. Google it, GORUCK, guys. It's hilarious, awesome, fun.
And, fun is not so, how I would describe what this experience was for you. But
yeah, it was. If you think about all these mud runs are very popular, and those are inspired by a military style training where you have military style obstacles and you're running up and down a mountain and a little crawling through mud and stuff like that. And those are great. And those last usually a couple hours in the middle of the day, and everybody's out there having a raw great time. And a typical CrossFitter, if you just do CrossFit, you can just show up, perform fine. You don't need to train for one of those things. But then we heard about something different. This is not just inspired by military training. It's run by special forces, military people. And this is not just a couple hours during the day. It's special forces hazing, endurance style, all night, wearing a rucksack filled with bricks. And so we were told that if you don't, as a CrossFitter, if you don't train for this, you'll get hurt. And we did. We trained. We, in addition to our CrossFit training, we loaded up the packs of bricks, and we're tromping up and down the hills and doing extra PT wearing the backpack full of bricks. And it was a rough experience. It was 13 hours of good living.
Yeah.
So, but that, what's neat is that we chose to do that, and this is within that big spectrum. It's towards one end of the spectrum. We chose to be ambitious and take this on as a goal of going and seeing, can we do something like this? Can we get ourselves to a ready state to be able to sustain ourselves in that way? And it was a neat project.
Yes.
Not doing it every week, though. that would cost too much.
Yeah.
Personally, not financially. It doesn't cost anything financially.
Right. And again, I mean, my point of connecting all of this about this ambition about one's body is not to be judgmental, particularly not to be judgmental of others. It's not your business. And as Jen notes in the chat, unless you know a person's details, you can't always judge someone's level of fitness by their appearance. And I agree with that completely. It's just like other people's physical fitness, their health, it's not your concern. I mean, I can understand being concerned about that with family members, people who you know a little bit better, if you know their medical history. Greg, I'm getting an echo again. But the point here, once again, is to underscore the importance of being ambitious about your whole self, not just about your character, but about your whole mind and about your whole body. And I do think in general here, it's critical to focus here on function rather than on outward appearance. Like, yes, it's great to look good naked. Pretty much everybody wants that. But it's also, if you focus on appearance, it's really easy to set unreasonable expectations, to become second-handed, or even to damage your health in pursuit of a certain look. So I would strongly recommend that people focus on function, of focusing on your body, being able to do what you want to do with it, whether in athletics or hobbies or sexually or whatever it is, and allow form to follow function. I think that's actually a much healthier strategy.
Oh, total agreement. That's one of the things I like about the kinds of body hacks and fitness activities that we and lots of people around us in our community have been picking up on over the past, I don't know, half decade. And that is form follows function, and that's what we really are after is capacity.
Right.
Capacity over the long haul in our lives. And it's like, yeah, that's a good thing to optimize. So speaking of integrity and pride, what about brushing your teeth with integrity and pride?
Yeah, so it's not that like the particular concrete action is going to be done with integrity and pride, although I do think you could even describe it that way, but rather that you can take a serious approach to your dental health in accordance with those virtues. So I'm actually a really good example of this. I have particularly problematic gums, and I end up with really inflamed gums and very sensitive teeth and so on if I don't really tend to my dental health. So I see my hygienist every 3 months. I have to take extra care. When I get stressed out, my dental health goes to crap. And so I do those things. I do particularly when I think about it as when I'm in maintenance mode, I'm just doing the regular things that I need to do. That's a matter of integrity. And when I need to like up my game, that's a matter of pride. And maybe that seems silly to apply that to dental health, but I actually think it's not. one of the major benefits of egoism is that prosaic actions like this take on moral significance. Everything that you do impacts your life, even brushing your teeth. And so, look, like, get out there and go do it and do it well. And don't skimp on this because, oh, it's, you know, it's not important, it's just my teeth. No, like, that can actually really make a difference in your quality of life, in your overall health, and so on. Don't neglect those kind of things.
Give everything its due, even if its due is rather modest.
Yes.
Yeah. Cool. So what's the take-home point?
So a person's bodily health matters hugely to his well-being and longevity. New virtues are not required to account for this. However, the virtues of integrity and pride do apply in spades. And I just want to mention, I thought this was a great question, and it's a great question for me, like, just right now at this point in my life, because I've been thinking a lot about growth mindsets lately. I've been I'm actually been working on being much more ambitious in all areas of my life, including with respect to my own body lately. And as a result of that, answering this question has really deepened my understanding of the virtue of pride. And this is, it's fortuitous because I have AtlasCon lectures from a few years ago on pride that I've been wanting to update and re-record. And now I get to add a whole new layer about expanding one's understanding of what pride is and what it applies to and thinking about growth mindsets and so on. And I'm very excited.
Nice. All right. A little bit of follow-up action here. Robert asks, is there actual evidence that Rand didn't pay attention to her bodily health?
So this was something that came up actually in Barbara Brandon's book in the first chapter, where, you know, she talked about Ayn Rand's aversion to any kind of physical exercise and so on. And I think I must have asked, it came up in a personal conversation with Leonard Peikoff at one point, and he absolutely said that that was completely true. She was just averse to doing any kind of physical exertion at all. And I also think, look, the dangers of smoking were not as well known as they are today, but those were pretty, it was not as people were not in as much ignorance as sometimes people say. It was known that there was a connection between smoking and lung cancer. And in fact, I mean, I remember Leonard Peikoff's rationalization of this at one point. And this was back, I mean, folks who heard his lectures, like his logic lectures, will hear him start up a cigarette like every 3 minutes while he's giving his lectures. I mean, he is chain smoking during these lectures. And I think even after he quit, his view was like, yeah, I mean, sure, there might be a you know, some kind of correlation between smoking and lung cancer. But until you have particular evidence that smoking has affected you, there's absolutely no reason to quit. And you know what? He suffers from emphysema and so on. Now, I mean, he clearly had long-term effects, which didn't show up until later. But they were not, you know, it's not exactly rocket science. This was not exactly rocket science. This was known. And I don't actually think that that's rational. I don't think that's the approach that one wishes to take to one's health. Is I'm going to keep doing this thing, which I actually have a good bit of evidence is likely to cause me problems, until I actually experience those problems, at which point it's going to be actually too late. Right? And I don't think that that's the right approach to dealing with one's body. I think you need a more proactive you need a kinder approach to your body.
Yeah. Okay. And he also asks, Robert also asks, or mentions, but Rand, like Aristotle, encompassed all other aspects of life under the umbrella of ethics. So what you're saying, isn't that variance with what she said, though her emphasis maybe was different?
Well, I would recommend that you just go read what she wrote about pride. And it's really focused on moral character. And it's not focused on developing either one's other mental aspects or on certainly not on developing the body. So at least the way she frames it, it's all about moral ambitiousness, and it's not about other kinds of ambition in life. So that's all I have to say about that.
Sorry, yeah, character development seemed to be her focus there. All right, Andrew asks, it's very difficult to watch people you love who flagrantly don't take care of their bodies and watching the physical problems that inevitably follow. I'm thinking parents as an example. When should you intervene, and when should you completely butt out? Any advice?
I think that one can give suggestions if they seem receptive, but ultimately it's their life, and you can provide a good example. You can yourself, you know, choose not to eat junk food and exercise, and hopefully they can see the difference in you. But it's not as if their problems are not evident to them. The only thing is that oftentimes people think that there is no solution, or that any solution would be too difficult. But, you know, I mean, I would generally be wary about butting in those kinds of cases, unless you think that ignorance is the issue. If you do say anything, don't be judgmental about it, and say, you know, mom and dad, look, I want you to be healthy and happy and live a long time, and it concerns me that, you know, here you're on yet another blood pressure medication, something like that.
Yeah, that's hard.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't see any other fun follow-up action.
Hour and a half, baby.
Hour and a half.
I think we still need to do rapid fire if you've got time.
Okay, a little bit of rapid fire. Hold on one second here. Okay, it's rapid fire question time. We're going to put Diana in the hot seat, ask a couple questions from this long and growing queue in any old order, my any old order, because I'm the decider now. And she hasn't planned what she's going to say, so get interesting. Let's see. Would it be wrong to say, when you die, nothing happens, instead of, God bless you, when someone sneezes?
Yes.
that seems a little uncalibrated.
It seems. I was hoping you'd choose that question.
Come into it.
That showed up in the queue, and I was like, what? What? Yeah.
Yes, that seems like a topic change, but it's a little startling.
Yes, I would not recommend this. I do like Gesundheit, good health. I mean, you know, it seems it's a funny convention that we have that when somebody, you know, does a certain kind of bodily noise, right? Sneezing. You know, we don't do it for hiccups. We don't do it like when somebody farts in our presence, we don't say, oh, bless you.
well, that's a real evil spirit you let go. I hope that doesn't come back. Yeah.
But we just do this for sneezing. Anyway, I think it's sort of a funny convention, and I tend to pervert Gesundheit, but just because it's not religious, but I don't think that there's anything wrong with bless you.
Yeah, it's just a well wish. Kind of like saying, hi, how you doing in our culture really means hello.
Right.
How you doing?
Right.
Okay, so moving on. Is it okay to copy and distribute someone's intellectual property if that person doesn't believe in intellectual property?
No. I still think, like, look, there's people in the world who don't believe in intellectual property. There's people who don't believe in physical property. I don't think that justifies stealing their stuff. It seems like mean and pointed, and it's not a matter that they don't deserve it. Forget about that. It's a matter that this is not how you wish to act towards other people. This is not this, like, particularly it's not just violating their intellectual property is not a habit that you wish to develop, but that gotcha mentality that I really dislike. I think that's actually really, really inimical to good relationships.
So would a parallel here be that it's like, well, okay. If somebody doesn't believe in respecting other people's rights and not, say, aggressing on them, does that make it okay to walk up and punch them?
Yeah.
No, you don't want to go around thinking of opportunities to take someone out that way.
Right, or even just this person thinks that honesty isn't a virtue. Does that mean I should just go lie to them all the time? No, like, just don't play those games with people. I think that's really destructive to your own self, and it's really not going to be good for any kind of relationship with them or anybody else nearby in the future.
Yeah. So there's that training thing that you're doing. You're focusing your attention in a certain way and training your subconscious to be attentive to those opportunities. These are not opportunities you want to be attentive to.
Right, right.
It's not good training. There is a – if somebody doesn't believe in intellectual property and they've put their work in the public domain, of course it's okay to use it because it's in the public domain.
And you're not.
But don't claim it as yours.
Right,
it's not yours.
Right. But anybody who puts their work in public domain that's, you're free to you know, download and print that or whatever else you want to do with it other than claim it as yours and sell it. That's totally independent of their views on intellectual property.
Yeah.
It would be ironic. I mean, it would be a little bit hypocritical if somebody wrote a work on why intellectual property is complete bunk and then copyrighted it. I mean, like, by all means, go ahead and make fun of the person for that, but don't violate their intellectual property rights.
Yeah. And maybe this one last here. Isn't there a risk in a society without government welfare that the poor would commit crimes in order to go to prison and get free food, shelter, and so forth? Yikes.
One would hope that the number of people who would do that would actually be quite small. Secondly, I'm not convinced that prisons are the way to go in terms of state punishment of criminals. What else? I also don't think that prisons should be, if they exist, should be that cushy that you would be getting free food and shelter and every life would be cushy and great. So.
Yeah. And if you have the means, of course, you'd be paying for that anyway. And it's like, yeah, we'll bill you.
Yeah. Or you're going to be working in prison because you need to pay for your own upkeep. Yeah. Which
yeah.
Case, you might as well work on the outside. So.
All right. Moving on. Because it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, bonus edition. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
So I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email all of that to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
So if you do want to see what's on tap in the next few weeks, visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. So I won't be broadcasting at all next week. The week after that, I will have both a Thursday and a Sunday show.
Excellent. I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. The show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.